right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're going to have a pretty damn good show today, all right? First, you're going to be hearing a piece, a trailer for a new speech, a new film, actually, an hour-long film that's available at revcom.us, and it's really, you can see the whole thing, but today you're going to see a trailer, and it's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. The title of the talk in the film is "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible." But let me first tell you about the rest of the show. The novelist William Faulkner wrote, "The past is never dead. It's not even past." And we're living in a time when there are many lessons and analogies and warnings that people are deriving from history. At the back end of the show, we're going to hear an interview I did with historian and author James Loewen about the Civil War, a war begun over slavery. James Loewen traces how this fact, which is easy to discover, has been covered up and distorted to the point that even teachers of history are part of trying to confuse people about the blatant white supremacy behind all of the Confederate flags and monuments and behind all the talk of our heritage. And opening the show up, we're going to be talking about the Hollywood blacklist, McCarthyism, and the intensely repressive political atmosphere it created in the 1950s. There's going to be a special program marking the 70th anniversary of the beginning of the blacklist in Los Angeles, and we're going to be talking to our first guest about it.
And our guest is going to be Ed Rampell, a film historian, author, and critic, and a writer for Hollywood Progressive. He's the organizer of the 70th anniversary commemoration of the Hollywood blacklist. And it's going to be a really, really interesting event, and we'll talk with Ed about that in about 10 minutes or so. All right, so let's go to the trailer for the film of the speech by Bob Avakian, and it's a mind blower, so check this out.
We are confronted by, we are now being ruled by, a fascist regime, relentlessly assaulting civil rights and liberties and openly promoting bigotry and inequality. This has caused disgust, anger, and agonizing among huge numbers of people. And there have been many important acts of resistance, big and small, to the continuing outrages committed by this regime and its supporters. But the regime remains in power and is determined to ride roughshod over all obstacles to carry out its monstrous agenda. And the need for a massive outpouring of people, acting together nonviolently but with sustained determination to create a political situation where this regime cannot remain in power, cries out. The organization Refuse Fascism, refusefascism.org, has put forward a call and a plan and is actively building for that mass mobilization to begin on November 4. So this poses sharply the immediate urgent challenge we face. Calling this regime fascist is not an insult, but speaks to the terrible reality. There is a direct line from the Confederacy to the fascists of today, and a direct connection between their white supremacy, their open disgust and hatred for LGBT people as well as women, their willful rejection of science and the scientific method, their raw America First jingoism and trumpeting of the superiority of Western civilization, and their bellicose wielding of military power, including their expressed willingness and blatant threats to use nuclear weapons to destroy countries with the finger of a demented bully on the nuclear button. A regime that, without exaggeration, threatens not just greatly heightened suffering for the masses of humanity, but the very existence of humanity itself. It used to be a common saying, to the person of the right, order is more important than justice, while for the person of the left, it is the opposite. Now the question is put squarely to liberals and really to everyone. Which, after all, is more important? Order, even if that is the order of fascism, with everything that means? Or justice, even if that means stepping outside of our comfort zone and putting ourselves on the line to prevent this fascism from consolidating its rule and fully implementing its program. Whether we consider ourselves revolutionaries, convinced of the need for a radical overturning of the system and thorough transformation of society, or we believe that it is possible to bring about changes that will lead to a more just society within this system. Whether our understanding is that America is not and cannot be a force for good in the world, or we hope it still can become that, all of us need to come together and act together with the urgency that corresponds to the terrible present and the gravely imperiled future that this fascist regime represents for humanity, and with the conviction that something far better is necessary and possible. Thousands must be organized to take to the streets in cities all over the country, beginning on November 4, overcoming fear and feeling the strength of their common cause and action and their common aspiration and determination, making clear their resolve to not just make a statement, but to continue, and more than that, to spread and multiply their numbers and impact until millions have been mobilized and refuse to stop until the demand has been met. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go.
All right, welcome back. That was the trailer for a new talk by Bob Avakian. And the trailer, you can find it at revcom.us, or the whole film you can find at revcom.us, all right? And it's really, and it's a must-see. It's a must-see. And the film is The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. A talk by Bob Avakian. And once again, that's RevCom, R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M dot us. That's R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M as in Michael, dot U-S, okay? Go there and you'll see the hookup for this talk. And don't miss it, sisters and brothers. It's going to bend your mind. It's going to open your head. It's going to be a whole lot of new knowing, all right? That's what it's going to be. That's right. That's how I'm talking today, right? And I think it's really going to be extremely important in terms of what lies ahead of us, what the future is going to be. And the big step to the kind of future that humanity needs begins on November 4th. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go, stay in the streets day and night, until the Trump-Pence regime is driven out. So I'm going to play another short clip before we talk with Ed Rampell. Partly because I really think it's great. It's something that was inspired by Eminem, and it's done by a whole lot of different people in New York. And you can see the video on the Refuse Fascism Twitter feed, which is at Refuse Fascism.
It's the calm before the storm, right? How was I gonna start this? I forgot.
That's an awfully hot coffee pot.
Should I drop it on Donald Trump?
Probably not.
But more than that, I've got a plot.
Take to the streets November 4th and do not stop.
For the people of the world, not just our block.
Because what we got in office now is a kamikaze that can probably cause a nuclear holocaust.
And while he waits for to quiet down, he'll gas his plane up.
And fly around until the bombing stops.
Intensity's heightened. Tensions are rising. Trump, when it comes to giving a you're stingy as I am.
Racism's the only thing that he's fantastic for.
Because that's how he gets his rocks off.
And he's orange.
Yeah, sick tan.
Yeah, sick tan.
All these tragedies, and this man is bored and would rather get into a Twitter storm with the Packers.
Who's gonna pay for his extravagant trips back and forth with his fam from golf courts to mansions?
From his endorsement of Bannon, support for the Klansmen.
Tiki torches in hand for the soldier that's black and comes home from Iraq.
Is told to go back to Africa?
Fork and dagger for this 94-year-old racist grandpa who keeps ignoring our historical deplorable factors.
Now, if you're a black athlete, you're a spoiled little brat for trying to use your platform or stature to give a voice to those who don't have one.
That. This is for Colin. Ball up a fist and keep that bald like Donald the Pig.
He's gonna get rid of all immigrants. He's gonna build that thing up taller than this.
If he does build it, I hope it's rock solid with bricks.
Because like him in politics, I'm using all of his strengths.
Drawing a line in the sand. You're either for or against.
If you can decide who you like more and you split, I'll do it for you with this.
You, the rest of America, stand up.
We love humanity and we love this planet, but we hate Trump.
We love humanity and we love the planet.
But we hate Trump
and Pence.
All right, that was a piece from refusefascism.org. And so please go to the website for the sake of humanity and the planet. And that website is refusefascism.org. And right now, along the same theme, I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show Ed Rampell. Now, as I said earlier, Ed Rampell is a guy who's been wandering the streets of Hollywood for a long time, okay? And he can speak for himself on that. He's a film historian. He's an author, critic, and writer for Hollywood Progressive. He's the organizer of the 70th anniversary of the commemoration of the Hollywood Blacklist. It's called An American, a Reenactment of the HUAC Hearings, and it's happening at the Writers Guild Foundation. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. And those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And our event is going to be reminding America about what happened exactly 70 years ago that day on October 27th, 1947, when the very first member of the Hollywood 10, screenwriter John Howard Lawson, was called to testify by the fascistic House Un-American Activities Committee, and they gaveled him down and they threw him off the witness stand.
Well, give people, because this is something that actually helped to shape like an entire ethos, an entire, it dropped a cloud over the entire, you know, creative industry. It dropped a cloud. It was part of actually spreading a fascist, you know, rule over the rest of the country, a fascist, you know, going into that kind of stuff, bringing out the thing. If you spoke up, if you said one word, or you were even accused by an angry neighbor of speaking a word in favor or something in favor of, whether it was the Soviet Union or whether it was, you know, what was going on in China, or whether it was just talking about what was happening here and talking about that there seemed to be something wrong with a place that you couldn't actually have these actors and creative people actually stand up and say something about the conditions people are living in and what they need to do about it. Tell us a little bit more about actually what did happen, because as I read what you're bringing here, you're bringing the voices of a lot of, who no longer are around, the voices of people who are no longer around, but whose story really does have to be heard in order for people to understand the depth of the fascistic terrorism that we're living under now and how it's only going to get worse unless this regime is not driven out.
And in terms of spreading the cloud, we should never forget that two of our worst presidents, Nixon and Reagan, grew out of the House Un-American Activities Committee. They used anti-communism to develop their careers, and we are going to have a combination of blacklist survivors, including 100-year-old Marsha Hunt. She just turned 100 this week, and Norma Barsman, the blacklisted screenwriter, now 97, are joining the children, the grandchildren, the nieces, the nephews of the blacklisted, persecuted artists, plus a number of today's progressive Hollywood talents, such as Richard Dreyfuss, the Oscar winner, Rosario Dawson, James Cromwell, who, by the way, Jamie's father, John Cromwell, was blacklisted. Andrea Markovici, who played Woody Allen's girlfriend in The Hunt. Ileana Douglas. Now, that name Douglas, very interesting, because her grandfather was Melvin Douglas, and her grandmother was Helen Gehagen Douglas, who was the congresswoman who ran against Nixon, who parlayed HUAC into a run for the U.S. Senate, and he called Ileana Douglas's grandmother the Pink Lady and said she was pink down to her underwear. And another Douglas, unrelated, the granddaughter of Kelsey Douglas, is going to read a statement Personally written by Kirk Douglas for our historic remembrance about how Kirk helped to break the blacklist when he gave screen credit to the blacklisted screenwriter Dalton Trumbo, as did Otto Preminger in Exodus in 1960. We're also going to be joined by film director Jeremy Kagan, who did the greatest movie ever made about the new left in America called Catherine, based on the Weather Underground. And his new movie out is called Shot, about gun violence in America. K.B. Solomon is going to be portraying the great Paul Robeson. And in what our readers are going to be doing at the Writers Guild is reading portions of the transcripts of the testimony to the House Un-American Activities Committee that began in 1947, plus some personal remembrances and plus some other blacklist-related texts such as Red Channels.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking with Ed Rampell. Ed is a film historian, author, critic, and he's a writer for The Hollywood Progressive. And we're talking about the 70th anniversary commemoration of the Hollywood Blacklist, Un-American, a reenactment of the HUAC hearings. Tell me this, Ed, because one of the things we have a limited amount of time, and I think it's really impressive, all the people you have coming to speak to this, but there's also a point here about people understanding what it meant, because we're living under a fascist regime right now. What I think is really true is that, in fact, you're looking at Trump and you're looking at the Trump-Pence regime, and this is a fascist regime. There's not a question about that. The question is how quickly are they going to get it fully consolidated, and how are they going to roll it out? And I want people to understand, one, what did it mean both for these? Look, it was an era where people who dared to say anything at all, especially in the arts because of the influence of the arts, basically, people were smashed. They were hit very, very hard. It meant that, people committed suicide. It meant people could not work ever again. There were people that were, just left out there to, going to prison, all of these various things. And at the same time, it had a meaning for people and the type of society that was allowed to flourish after they had this kind of thing. And I'd like to talk about those two things. We have a few minutes, and then I know you have a big thing you want to let loose on to let us hear. As soon as we're done talking about this, then we're going to go into your big surprise.
Well, it was not only that you had to talk about what you did, but you also had to inform on everybody you knew. You had to be a snitch. You had to crawl like a rat in order to be allowed to continue working in the entertainment industry. This set up a climate of paranoia, of conformity, and fear in America, beginning with 1947, the HUAC hearings, and then going into the McCarthy era that started around 1950 or so. So this was an all-pervasive culture of paranoia. The Communist Party was a fully legal political organization in the United States, and yet you not only had to be associated with it, but refuse to name the names of people who went to meetings with you in the 1930s against fascism in Spain, or who went on a picket line with you, or helped build the Screenwriters Guild, and so on and so forth. So it was a very repressive culture, and we must never forget that Senator Joe McCarthy, who was in the Senate, HUAC was in the House, McCarthy had a separate committee in the Senate. We must never, ever forget who his attorney was. His chief counsel was Roy Cohn, who became Donald Trump's attorney and mentor. So we see this. You talked about a continuity at the top of your show from the Confederacy to fascism, with white supremacy being an important part of that component, of course. Now we could see the continuity from HUAC in the McCarthy era to the Trump regime with the full frontal attacks on the First Amendment that are going on today. And we saw what happened during the 1950s. Up to 300 people in Hollywood, actors, directors, screenwriters, producers, and others, were not allowed to work. Not only because they wouldn't recant and inform on themselves, but because they refused to be rats and to snitch and inform on others. And this was a climate of fear across the country. But what we are stressing in our program is the resistance, the defiance of so many people who confronted HUAC, who confronted McCarthyism, and were eventually triumphant.
So, all right, so I want to move in because we're running out of time. I want to move into your big...
And also people went to jail and were fined because they would not cooperate as friendly witnesses with the committee, by the way. I should add that.
And many people left, were forced to leave the country. There were writers' collectives and filmmakers' collectives that developed in places like England and places like, you know, other countries in Europe and around the world where people were actually forced to go to try and continue to produce their art, but also to stay alive. And, you know, you think about this. This was that fascist tendency that was there in the Congress and the rest of the stuff. And now you think about what we're doing today and what's happening today in terms of you actually have a fascist regime in power and it's moving very quickly to consolidate things. And
we must stop it.
What's that?
We must stop them.
Absolutely, Ed. Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. That's a really very important. So, Lau, tell us real you had a special announcement you wanted to make. You said that there was a big scoop I was going to get on my show. So let's go with it, brother.
For the first time ever in the United States, we will have a clip from the new French documentary called Red in Blue, which is a film about how Hollywood depicted the Russian Revolution, which turns 100 on November 7th. But the big scoop I have for you today is that I personally contacted the office of attorney Mark Geragos to invite the number one blacklisted talent today in America to participate in our historic remembrance of the witch hunt in Hollywood. And I'm talking about Mark Geragos' client, Colin Kaepernick. Colin, if you are listening, if you get word of this, join us. Come and take a knee, read some of the HUAC testimony, and let's remind everybody that the blacklisting, that talents like Colin Kaepernick today is what happened in America 70 years ago, and we're going to stop it. We're going to remind everybody. We're going to stop it and nip it in the bud before it gets worse.
All right, Ed, we're going to have to wrap this up now, but I want to let people know again, it's Un-American, a reenactment of the HUAC hearings, 70th anniversary commemoration of the Hollywood Blacklist. All right, Ed, thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Keep the faith.
All right, man, take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Ed Rampell, and he's been talking with us about the anniversary, the 70th anniversary, the commemoration of the Hollywood Blacklist, and it was which was part of fascistic tendencies in the country, in the Senate, in the Congress, and in other places that actually went after people who dared to speak up against what was going on in terms of against imperialism, against even, quite frankly, even against the mildest liberal opposition. People who opened their mouths were squashed. They were forced out of, they were not able to work. Some of them never able to work again. You know, their works that they had produced were stopped. And it was an era that, you know what? It was an era that everybody needs to learn about and understand. And as Ed was saying, you know, understand it. And there's an understand. And I would add that there's a reason to understand it because we're faced with something that's even more, okay? We're not talking about fascistic tendencies. We're not talking about people who may do this or may do that. We're not talking about people who will just solely put their eyes on what can they do in the realm of culture, although that is an important realm. We're not talking about people who are satisfied with making a few laws here and there. We are talking about, and we're not talking about people who might come into power. We are talking right now about a regime that is in power, that is a fascist regime, okay? That's what we're talking about. And if we sit here, If we sit here and pretend that we don't know that, if we sit here and pretend that there's not much that we can do, that we can wait until the, oh, I don't know, you know, the elections that come up in the next year or so, we can do something there, we can wait until the presidential elections, we'll be able to rope them in and control them. These are people who are hell-bent on consolidating as quickly as possible their fascist rule. And when you think about what that means, we've been having, you know, on this show, we've had tons and tons of people come in, people who are experts on what the Nazis did in Germany. And you think about today, how much more there is in terms of what the fascists can and will do. And they have promised to impose fascist forms of rule. They haven't said we're thinking about this, or, you know, if you don't watch it, we're going to do this. They have actually promised to impose fascist forms of rule, and they are keeping their promises every damn day, day after day. You can't open the newspaper without seeing something new, some new element of this. And they're putting the bars all in place. And so that what they want is the time comes, and some of them will go quicker. They'll make a big move and they'll go quicker. And what is it going to mean for the people here? What is it going to mean for the people who always suffer like the hardest here? What is it going to mean for oppressed nationalities? What's it going to mean for women? What's it going to mean for all people here? And what's it going to mean for the rest of the world? Think about this. They're talking about pillaging the world. They're already talking about the wars that they need to have. All the threats they've been making against North Korea. All of these things are related to the kind of regime we have, sisters and brothers. So we've got to learn from the past in order to analyze what's going on in the present. That's why I think the new talk, the new film of the talk by Bob Avakian, is so important. In fact, let's do another short clip from that, okay? This is a 1-minute clip about what we're facing.
We are confronted by, we are now being ruled by, a fascist regime. Calling this regime fascist is not an insult, but speaks to the terrible reality. There is a direct line from the Confederacy to the fascists of today, and a direct connection between their white supremacy, their open disgust and hatred for LGBT people as well as women, their willful rejection of science and the scientific method, their raw America First jingoism and trumpeting of the superiority of Western civilization, and their bellicose wielding of military power, including their expressed willingness and blatant threats to use nuclear weapons to destroy countries with the finger of a demented bully on the nuclear button. A regime that, without exaggeration, threatens not just greatly heightened suffering for the masses of humanity, but the very existence of humanity itself.
That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's a piece taken from his new talk, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be running an interview I did a number of years ago with Jim Lowen, the co-editor of the book, The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause.
Get 'em in, get 'em in. That sun is hot and plenty bright. Let's get on to business and get home tonight. Bid 'em in. Auctioning slaves is a real high art. Bring that young gal, Roy. She's good for a start. Bid 'em in, get 'em in. Now here's a real goodbye on about 15. Her great-grandmammy was a die-homie queen. Just look at her face. She sure ain't homely. Like Sheba in the Bible. She's black but comely. Bid 'em in. Gonna start at 3. Can I hear 3? Step up, gents. Take a good look. See.
Welcome back. That was Bid 'em In by Oscar Brown, the late, great Oscar Brown Jr. At a time when people are debating and struggling over what the Confederate flag and other symbols of slavery and white supremacy are all about, I thought that the following interview would shine a light of reality on Southern heritage and Southern pride and that great culture they all want to uphold. I spoke with James Lowen, co-editor of The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. This book uses the words and documents of the Confederates and Neo-Confederates themselves to show that the Confederate leaders were honest and out front about why they started the Civil War. It was to protect slavery and a society based on white supremacy and slavery and the perpetual subjugation of black people.
That's the heritage and tradition represented by the Confederate flag and all those statues and monuments to Confederate generals. So without any further ado, here's an interview I did a number of years back with James Loewen. I really am pleased to welcome to the show my next guest, James Loewen. Now, Jim's been a guest on the show a number of times before, and he's just come out with a new book, a book that he co-edited with Edward H. Sebesta. And the name of that book is The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. It's an incredibly, I mean, really a fascinating book. And again, once again, he's kind of opened my eyes up with, basically his ruthlessly honest and searching approach to history and really trying to make sure that people are talking about history accurately. Jim's the author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, and Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong. He's also the author of Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, and a few other books, all of which number among my favorite books. Jim, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you.
Okay, well, let's jump into this. As I said, this book was really kind of an eye-opener for me on many different levels. One, just the stuff that I learned, but also the kind of situation that you describe in the book. And I want you to tell people what the book is about and what compelled you to pull it together.
Sure. Well, I had another aha experience just last Friday. Now, of course, the book came out in August, and I wrote it before then. But this is the kind of thing that keeps happening. Last Friday, I was keynoting the American Association for State and Local History, which was meeting in Oklahoma City. Now, these are the folks who run history museums and historic houses and forts and stuff like that all across the U.S. So in the middle of my talk, I asked them, why did the South secede? Why did 11 states, beginning with South Carolina, leave the Federal Union? Well, there's always four answers you get, and they are: the South seceded over slavery, the South seceded because for states' rights, the South seceded because of the election of Lincoln, and the South seceded over tariffs and taxes, or issues about tariffs and taxes. So I said, okay, let's vote. And my one-liner is, unlike Chicago, you can only vote once. All right, everybody laughed, and then we proceeded to vote. And what happened was another one of these, we might call them an aha experience for me, only they've really become an oh-no experience. This time, more than 80% of the group voted states' rights. Now, states' rights always wins. When I do it with groups of teachers, it gets 60 to 75% of the vote. But here with historic site managers, it got at least 80%. Now, as you can already infer, that's not the right answer. Can I read from one of these documents?
Sure, definitely.
These folks just haven't ever read the documents, and the documents are never included, not even a phrase from them is included in American history textbooks that you have in high school. So the very first state to leave the Union was, of course, South Carolina, and they left it on Christmas Eve, 150 years ago this Christmas. And here's why. They say why. Quote, "We assert that 14 of the states have deliberately refused for years past to fulfill their constitutional obligations, and we refer to their own statutes for the proof." Now, that sounds vague, constitutional obligations, but they go right on to tell us what they're talking about. They go on, "The Constitution of the United States, in its fourth article, provides as follows, quote, no person held to service or labor in one state, under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due." Well, that is, of course, the Fugitive Slave Clause. Mm-hmm. And so it's beginning to look like slavery might be the right answer. And then they go on to talk about states' rights. And amazingly enough, they are against states' rights. And they tell us exactly which states and which rights upset them. And, for instance, they say the states of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, and they name all the states going out to Iowa, all these states have enacted laws which either nullify the acts of Congress or render useless any attempt to execute them. And they go right back to the fugitive slave problem. And then they talk about, for example, the state of New York. Now, New York no longer allows what's called slavery transit. So this was a kind of idea, for instance, that let's suppose you're a rich family in Charleston, and you don't want to spend August in Charleston. You want to spend it maybe watching Broadway plays. But you don't want to do your own cooking, so you want to bring your cook along. Well, New York says, we're trying to be a free state. If you bring a slave into New York, she becomes free. Well, South Carolina is outraged at this. They're outraged as well with New England, because the New England states let blacks vote. Well, who votes in America was a state's right until the 15th Amendment gets passed two whole eras after this. But nevertheless, South Carolina takes it upon themselves to say, this is another reason we're seceding. These people are letting blacks vote. It's an outrage. So in other words, it's all about slavery and about the connecting thing with slavery, namely white supremacy. And it has nothing at all to do with states' rights, except that the southern states are against states' rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very important point you make. And, you know, one of the things that you talk about, too, and you just sort of briefly mentioned this, but that this is, you know, there's all these other forces in society. You talk about historic site managers, but you also mentioned in your book even things like the National Archives website and yep. and teachers who really have they're teaching things that are completely untrue about what was behind the Civil War.
Yep.
And you know, and then textbooks, and that really sort of sits in your stomach and just makes you
sick. Let me mention even in a way a worse one, because it's so blatant. Many folks in California have become naturalized citizens, right? They came mm-hmm. in from Mexico or Vietnam or wherever they came in from as non-citizens, and then in order to become a citizen, you have to pass a history test, among other things. Mm-hmm. This is 100 multiple-choice questions. Each of them has one right answer, except for one question. The question, why did the southern states secede? And that one, they allow two right answers. Either the right answer, slavery, or if you say the wrong answer, states' rights, they count that right, too. So it's the only question on this federal test that has two right answers. And that right there shows the power of what we call the neo-Confederates even today.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with James Loewen. He's the co-editor of a new book called The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. I wanted to pursue this thing about the textbooks a little bit because,
sure.
you know, and it's related to what you just said. You know, in the book, you sort of cite a certain amount of relativism in the presentation of what was the cause of the Civil War. Like you're saying right now with these two possible correct answers.
Yeah.
You know, and they come out and there's a thing where people are saying even you can't know for sure what was really the cause of the Civil War.
You can too.
Right, exactly, exactly. Well, I agree with you. And you present a few reasons why this happens, because it's very, you know, it's should give people pause to think that the textbooks are being written from a standpoint of you can't know for sure. And like you said, you can too. Why do you think the textbooks are written like this?
They don't want to offend anybody. And, you know, it's interesting. Like, when I speak all over the country. And when I speak in Columbia, South Carolina, for instance, I usually speak about what we get wrong about the Civil War and secession. You know, I have a talk, for instance, about what we get wrong about the American Indians and about the Pilgrims, but I save that for Massachusetts. Because I don't want to pull any punch, you know. And people come, and they listen, and even people like the Sons of Confederate Veterans, they come, they then ask questions. I don't think I've convinced them all, but they at least listen. But the textbook publishers are too timid to do that. And so they imagine that they might lose an adoption, and all of the southern states adopt statewide. Most infamously, of course, Texas adopts statewide. It's a more or less southern state. And the publishers certainly don't want to offend Texas. And saying just flatly that the South seceded for slavery might offend somebody. So let's not say that. And they'll say, well, historians debate why the Confederacy left the Union. Some say slavery, some states' rights, issues about tariffs, the election of Lincoln. They'll say all four of those in one paragraph. And they will never quote a document to support their position. And I think the key reason is because all of the documents support only one position, and that's slavery. Well, they do mention the election of Lincoln, that's for sure. But they're upset with the election of Lincoln because Lincoln represents a new party which is against slavery. So it all comes back to the S word in the end.
You know, one of the things that you mention in this, in the book, is you give about four reasons, and I really wanted to try and zero in on at least a couple of them, because one of them is you say, or maybe just this one, but you say that there's actually this point of not wanting to offend anybody, as you've just been talking about. And, you know, I just spoke with Peter Ward, who he's an environmental writer. He writes on climate change and melting of the ice caps, and he's also a paleontologist. And he was talking about the terrible time he has in trying to get what he's discovered or uncovered about the truth about global warming and the rest of this and climate change, and trying to get it out there, he gets a lot of flack. And he said that actually he's found that there's a tremendous amount of scientific reticence among scientists who are basically censoring themselves because they don't want to step out of the flock. They don't want to put themselves out there, not just because of the crude reason of I won't get, you know, research money, but also because they don't want to take the chance of being out there as the point man for something that is going to attract a lot of flack in society in general. Do you think that's also true in relation to these textbooks and how they're being written? And the fact that teachers even won't go to the sources that you have proven through this really impressive collection of Confederate and neo-Confederate documents that actually show the truth. Do you think that kind of reticence is also operational here?
Sure. I'd still just call it under the general heading of timidity. But yeah, they don't want to be the one textbook that gets off of Tennessee, for instance, adopts every competent book just about in American history. And actually, Tennessee would not knock a book out for this reason, I don't think. But publishers imagine they might, you know? So let's not say it.
Yeah, see, and that's the problem is when you're dealing with the question of seeking the truth, it's a big problem because if you're going to then present to others, and especially in the, you know, involving textbooks and teachers, you would think that the purpose is to bring the truth to people in the classrooms. And
yeah, especially because the darn books are so huge. You know, the second edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me came out about 3 years ago, and it'll be the last edition, I can assure everyone. I'm not going to read any more of these textbooks. They're such a near-death experience. For that edition, I read six more of these books, and they've actually gotten longer. They now average 1,152 pages. And yet, with all those pages, they don't quote any documents, or almost no documents. For example, one of them actually has two whole paragraphs about Bryan's famous Cross of Gold speech, William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech. These two leaden paragraphs written by whoever writes these textbooks, it isn't usually the names that are on them, only use three words from Bryan, and those are cross of gold. Now, William Jennings Bryan is a powerful writer, you know. He writes something like, thou shalt not press down upon labor's brow this crown of thorns. Thou shalt not crucify mankind on a cross of gold. Any 11th grader, any 6th grader could understand that better than they can understand the words of the textbook writers. But they don't quote them. And so they have this tradition of not quoting. They could just hide behind the documents. I think that'd be just fine. You know, let South Carolina tell you why it seceded. South Carolina's quite upfront about it.
Well, let's dig into this, because actually the point that you make in the book and what you show through all these documents is exactly what you're saying. They're upfront about this. There's the question of the Confederacy was really about, the Civil War was really about the preservation of slavery as an economic system, and then all the ideological trappings that go along with that, racism and white supremacy and so on. And, you know, the part of the problem or part of the thing that comes up here is, so you've mentioned in your most recent book what really happened. You get into the question of historiography, and I'm
yes.
curious as to how that applies to this situation.
Oh, it does indeed. That's a good question. And the reason our book is titled The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader is because we don't just have documents from the Confederacy period itself. After the Civil War ends, of course, we have Reconstruction. And now the same people, in this case, they're still Confederates. We might call them ex-Confederates because you can't be a Confederate anymore. But they still want to maintain their point of view. They can't maintain slavery because that was ended by the 13th Amendment. But they certainly can maintain white supremacy, which is, of course, the handmaiden of slavery. And so they do. I mean, at the end of Reconstruction, they reimpose white supremacy. And then, in 1890, beginning with Mississippi, all of the southern states proceed to keep blacks from voting, quote, legally, unquote. I mean, it's really illegal because it's all a violation of the 14th and 15th Amendments. But the U.S. doesn't do anything about it, and so they actually do it, quote, legally. Well, this sets in motion what we call the Nader. Some people pronounce it Nadir, N-A-D-I-R. We're not talking Ralph. the Nader of race relations. And this is the period 1890 to 1940 when the U.S. goes more racist in its ideology and its thinking than at any other point in our history. And it's during this time, then, that the Neo-Confederates, and we have to call them Neo-Confederates now because most of the Confederates are dead. We're talking 1890 to 1940. It's a new generation. But they still maintain elements of the Confederate line. They certainly maintain the emphasis on white supremacy. And now they actually rename the Civil War, and they no longer call it the Civil War. Now is when it gets called the War Between the States. And now, 1890 to 1940, is when they start making the claim that secession was for states' rights. And so if you just page through our book, you can see the reasons for secession changing as you go through the years and as you go through the pages.
I was going to ask you about that in terms of the through line between the Confederates and the neo-Confederates. It's, you know, this point about maintaining this notion of white supremacy and the inferiority of black people to white people. It's not that they're still fighting the Civil War in one sense, but in another sense, they are still fighting. And it's not so much to reinstitute slavery, but it does this question of actually maintaining the domination of black people, the subordinate position of black people and the domination of them by white people in relation to the whole political and economic setup certainly seems to be serviced by this continuation of that understanding of the Civil War.
And you know, one thing a lot of people don't realize, a lot of younger people don't have any idea that the Republicans weren't always the party of white supremacy as they now are. In the 19th century, the Democrats were the party of white supremacy. And they said so, and they called themselves the white man's party well into the 1920s. But in 1964, the two parties completed a flip-flop on this matter. And as one of the actual documents in our book, we show two maps of votes for president for Abraham Lincoln in 1860 and then for John Kerry in 2004. And by gosh, the same states that Abraham Lincoln carried, John Kerry carried, with only three exceptions. Lincoln carried Iowa, Ohio, and Indiana, and Kerry didn't manage to carry them. But the map looks almost identical. So the people, it's a flip-flop then, of the people who supported Kerry were, in their antecedent generations, the people who supported Lincoln.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with James Loewen. He's the co-editor of a new book called The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. Now, let's talk about the relevance of all this for today. You know, I have to tell you, when my son was growing up, I was living in Washington, D.C., and one of the things that happened, here we were living in a majority black city, and yeah, the neighborhood we were in, it was majority black and immigrant, and my son was really deep into watching The Dukes of Hazzard.
Yes.
And he wasn't the only one in the neighborhood, and he wasn't the only nationality, you know, in the neighborhood,
yeah,
in terms of, you know, watching it. It was actually all the kids, they all went out and they got big wheels, they used to call them, that came.
Yeah, and I think what we have to do is we have to tell your readers that The Dukes of Hazzard drove around in this red car that had a Confederate flag painted on its roof.
That's exactly where I was going.
I knew that's where you're going.
Right, exactly. And my son got a big wheels that came complete with Confederate flags to stick all over the place, patches, all this stuff. He was so irate when I told him he was not going to put that on there. But it just struck me in thinking about this, because at that time there was that thing going on. And then I remember at the same time there was the struggle to have Martin Luther King's birthday declared a holiday. And at one point, Virginia opted,
yes,
to, they said, okay, we'll do it, but we're going to do it on the same day as Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson Day.
Yep.
You know, and to me, you know, it really fits in a lot with what you're actually pointing out in this book.
Yep. At this point, the neo-Confederates have, in terms of any explicitness, they've kind of given up on white supremacy. And so the most recent document we include in the book, actually, is Republican Governor Sonny Perdue of Georgia, his proclamation of Confederate History Month 2 years ago. And, of course, like all proclamations, it's got all these whereases. But it's very interesting that the number one whereas in there is this one. Whereas, among those who served the Confederacy were many African Americans, both free and slave, who saw action in the Confederate armed forces in many combat roles. Well, that's not true. That's flatly not true. It's less true than the idea that there's a whole bunch of Jewish officers in Hitler's army, which actually was true. There were no blacks in combat roles in the Confederate Army who were known to be black until 3 weeks before the end of the war. And the reason there weren't is because the Confederate policy wouldn't allow it. And so we include these documents that we don't allow no blacks. And then we furthermore include the document 3 weeks before Richmond gets liberated where they changed their minds. And so why, the question comes up, why would Sonny Perdue write something that's so completely false? And I think the answer is, the reason it goes like this. Look, you people, we're going to celebrate Confederate Heritage Month, and we all should celebrate it because it couldn't have been about slavery. It couldn't have been about white supremacy because, look, all these black folks fought on our side. See? It's a non sequitur, but besides that, it didn't happen.
But let me ask you this, the point about white supremacy. I know what you're saying in terms of they sort of similarly to how the neo-Confederates had to back off of actually doing the thing around, well, we were about slavery and we did think slavery was important and all this, and they couldn't really make that the central argument point. But they could then get into white supremacy. And, you know, you saw it in a lot of different ways where they were talking about, they were so upset. All the way up into the 1970s, they were still arguing about the natural stupidity of black people.
Oh, yeah.
And it's developed over the course of time. But it seems to me it's a little hard, I think, to say that they have given up on the promotion of white supremacy because you look at this.
Oh, I still think that's their goal. It's certainly the goal of the Council of Concerned Citizens, for instance,
exactly,
which is one of the primary neo-Confederate organizations around right now. And people who are in the sense of Confederate veterans fall into two groups, I think. The white supremacists and people who lost family members generations ago, admittedly, but still, in the Confederate Army, and they want to mainly honor them. And I appreciate that that's a different frame of mind. But there's something dangerous about the whole states' rights claim. And what's dangerous about it is that it has converted the Confederacy into kind of a David against Goliath romantic figure with whom we wish to identify. And this has several payoffs to today. Let me just mention a couple of them. I was just in Oklahoma City at this meeting. And, of course, Oklahoma City, about 10 years ago, was the site of this horrific bombing of the federal building, the Murrah office building. The number one guy who did it, Timothy McVeigh, he was photographed, arrested, I think, and certainly photographed for his mugshot, wearing a T-shirt. And it was a neo-Confederate T-shirt. And the T-shirt says, it has a picture of Abraham Lincoln in the front, and it says, "Sic semper tyrannis, thus always with tyrants," which is, of course, what John Wilkes Booth yelled on the stage of Ford's Theater right after he killed him. And so McVeigh is identifying with Booth. McVeigh is saying, we should kill the president. We should kill our leaders. Well, you're hearing that from some of the far-out members of the Tea Party folks. This woman in Nevada says, you know, bring your guns to Washington, and so on. And there is talk about secession by candidates for governor in Georgia, by the governor of Texas, by Mr. Sarah Palin, if you will, when he was a member of the Alaska First Party. That's a secessionist party in Alaska. And it's not necessarily totally harmless. I mean, the folks in Oklahoma City don't think this ideology is harmless one bit.
One of the things your book pointed out to me that I had no idea and hadn't really followed, and I'm sure, again, if I had really looked into it, as you say, the documents are there. What is the name of the journal, The Southern Partisan? And then
yes,
there's the book by the Kennedy. I guess they're brothers.
Yes, these are two neo-Confederate Kennedys.
Right.
The South was right.
The South was right. Right. I was going to say that's the basic premise of their book. And also this guy, Frank Connor. These are things that still play a very, not just, you know, symbolic role in American politics today, but actually some of these people have direct links to whether it's the Christian fundamentalist movement or McCain's campaign or any of these things.
They do. Trent Lott was tied in with them. Of course, he's out of politics now, but he wasn't. He was minority leader of the Senate, sometimes majority leader, depending on which side James Jeffers was on.
All right, Jim, one last question here. Speaking from your heart, from the very bottom of your heart, the importance of this book today and why people should pick this thing up.
Here's what I want folks to do. And I don't usually flog my books. They seem to do okay without it. But I want folks, including black folks, to buy this book with what we usually call the Confederate flag on the cover. It's the battle flag, anyway. Mm-hmm. And I want them to buy it and read it and keep it nice. Don't mark in it. Make your notes on the side on a piece of paper. And then take it to your nearby public high school and give it to your kid's history teacher or your own history teacher if you're young enough to have already just graduated from high school. Hit him upside the head with it and say, look, it's been 150 years. It's time to stop lying. It's time to get this right. It does make a difference. And then, by gosh, maybe we can change these historic sites, for instance, by simply having visitors go who know better and who hit them upside the head with this book and say, no. You cannot make it about states' rights anymore. That is a white supremacist myth. It removes the number one issue, which was race and slavery, from its position at the center of American history, and it just won't do anymore.
Jim Lowen talking about the Confederate and neo-Confederate reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause. All right, sisters and brothers, we're getting close to the end of the show, and I've got a couple more things from Bob Avakian that I want to share with you. Two more short clips from the Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. Now, the first is called Order or Justice? And the second is, What Can We Do? This is the most important question that people can ask today.
We are confronted by, we are now being ruled by, a fascist regime. It used to be a common saying, to the person of the right, order is more important than justice, while for the person of the left, it is the opposite. Now the question is put squarely to liberals, and really to everyone. Which, after all, is more important? Order, even if that is the order of fascism, with everything that means, or justice, even if that means stepping outside of our comfort zone and putting ourselves on the line to prevent this fascism from consolidating its rule and fully implementing its program. We are confronted by, we are now being ruled by, a fascist regime. Whether we consider ourselves revolutionaries, convinced of the need for a radical overturning of the system and thorough transformation of society, or we believe that it is possible to bring about changes that will lead to a more just society within this system. Whether our understanding is that America is not and cannot be a force for good in the world, or we hope it still can become that, all of us need to come together and act together with the urgency that corresponds to the terrible present and the gravely imperiled future that this fascist regime represents for humanity, and with the conviction that something far better is necessary and possible. Thousands must be organized to take to the streets in cities all over the country, beginning on November 4, overcoming fear and feeling the strength of their common cause and action and their common aspiration and determination, making clear their resolve to not just make a statement, but to continue, and more than that, to spread and multiply their numbers and impact until millions have been mobilized and refuse to stop until the demand has been met. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go.
All right, that was Bob Avakian from his new talk, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests, Ed Rampell, film historian, author, and critic, and writer for The Hollywood Progressive, and James Lowen, sociologist and author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your High School History Textbook Got Wrong, and the Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader. As always, you can find book titles, websites, and other information on my guests on my Facebook page. And you can also find it on my website, which is themichaelslateshow.com. I also want to thank the people who worked on today's show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and the engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Troubled Times by Green Day. Talk to you again next week. What good is love and peace on earth when it's exclusive? Where's the truth in the written word? If no one reads it, a new day dawning comes without warning. So don't think twice. We live in troubled times.